Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 177, Tsongkhapa's Profound and Miraculous Wisdom.
So, hello everybody, how are you? This is a short thing on this book, which is a reprint and a new edition of a book that was published by the Library of Tibetan Work and Archives in Dharamsala, I think in the 1970s, I believe in the 1970s, in which I, or some of my translations, and an introduction by me also, and Life and Teachings of Tsongkhapa, and also the translations of other texts by Tsongkhapa that had been done by other people. I was at the time, as a youngish at the time, translator, still in my 30s, because I edited this in the 70s, early 70s, I was trying to show ecumenism by not changing terminology much of a lot of the people who did the other translations, to show that even though I didn't necessarily approve of that terminology. And in this second edition, I have a little bit edited a little more of their terminology, but left still the gist of their work intact, and because I still feel we should be ecumenical. Although I also feel now at my age in my 70s, 40 years later, that finally one of these days we have to come down to a meeting of minds, all the translators, as the Tibetans did under the Emperor Tisong Detsen in the 9th century. Late 8th, early 9th century, when they translated the first draft, you could say, of the Kandyur and Tendyur, the collection of Buddha's own scriptural works and the collection of the scientific treatises and commentaries on those works. They set a kind of catalog of terminology, like a concordance of terminology, and people were expected to stick to it, and they more or less did. And what is nice about that is that, to some extent, the reader in the new language, who doesn't know the old language, can find the same connections between words as the people in the original language. But it's not perfect, and it never will be, because actually, in different sectors of the original Sanskrit, you know, whether it's logician, epistemology, high philosophy, Dharma practice, meditative technology, etc., in the different zones of the even arts and sciences and medicine, etc., sometimes the same Sanskrit word will have a different meaning in the original, actually. So, in a way, it can't be absolutely perfect. But for someone to read two different translators of works of this in the same area and have a completely different word for a word that does mean the same thing in those two different works from the same area, like say in Madhyamaka, that's kind of too bad. Although, because the way people are, translators are, and they like certain words, we could have sometimes two or three options, but really no more than that, maybe, you know. And maybe some discussion of which of those options is more useful in Oxford Dictionary level translator's dictionary, which we hope to get to one of these days, maybe in my next life. Okay, so anyway, it's a great work. It has a lot of because it's because of Tsongkhapa is great. And we're in a great year for Tsongkhapa, because in December of, or we're approaching the great year of Tsongkhapa, in December of 2019 is the 600th anniversary of Tsongkhapa's parinirvana, you could say, or you could call it, maybe that's not the right word, you call it his yuganada in tantric context, his attainment of the communion body, as I like to call it. Some people will call it simply union, some people will call it integration. I used to call it integration body, but I have reason now for wanting to call it communion body, and I think that's the best, and but only my opinion. And at the moment of death, and the reason he hadn't attained that before was communion body, you have to be male and female yourself in one body, sort of, but therefore one person in two bodies, you could say, like two lovers who are so deeply in love that in a way they're fully empathetic with each other and they feel each other's feelings, and yet they are separate feeling the other's feeling. And so they're sort of both separate and united. And the come in the communion is what makes that. Integration and union make it seem like they just became one, and neither one is sort of separately appreciated that in their own way. So communion means two people as one and to both. Like a little more challenging, non-dual, you know. And that's why I like that. And I don't care that it happens to fit with some Christian term. But that's just as well. It's a nice term. It means a nice thing in Christianity, but it doesn't mean this, but it means a nice thing. And you know, future Oxford English Dictionary will have Buddhist meaning and Christian meaning. And Buddhist one will be a little sexier. Anyway, so that's about translation terminology. Okay, so here it is. And I thought actually maybe to would be very good. There is a wonderful thing that I don't think has any been published anywhere else in this, which has to do with a Nyingma Kadam Lama called Lotak Kenchen Namka Gyantsen, who lived in the same time as Tsongkhapa. He was a little older than Tsongkhapa. And he is very worshipped and revered. He was a Nyingma and a Kadampa combination, because not everyone in Tibet was sectarian at all, really, very much. And there are, in this book also has things from Kagyus and Sakyas and Nyingmas, because Tsongkhapa had many teachers from those schools. In fact, the Sakyas in particular were kind of sad that Tsongkhapa's great renaissance that he did was not sort of within the framework of the Sakya order, but instead he chose a less powerful and by that time more diminished order called the Kadam order. And his main patrons were in the Kagyu order, actually. The Pagmo Drupa Kagyus, the Jigung Kagyus, and others were mainly his main patrons of Tsongkhapa. And so, you know, the Kadam didn't have a lot of big, wealthy Tibetan lords at the time. But that's the one he chose, the one without a wealthy patron, actually. And also another nice thing I like about Tsongkhapa, he declined, politely, the invitation of the Emperor of China at the time to go down and be honored by the Emperor of China. Because he knew, like, as we know, that if you do that, then they claim they own your country. So you have to be careful about that. They tend to, even in the old days. So, you know, because they're the central country and everybody's supposed to be, like, pay tribute to them. It's their culture. So there's this wonderful thing called Garland of Supremely Healing Nectars. And it's a dialogue between Karma Vajra, the Nyingma master, Lodak Kenchen, and Bodhisattva Vajrapani, actual celestial bodhisattva, like in his angelic form, the fierce one, the one who's known as sort of representing the power of the Buddhas, you know. Avalokiteshvara represents the compassion of all Buddhas, Manjushri represents the wisdom of all Buddhas, and Vajrapani represents the power, energy, of all, and the competence of all Buddhas. And he's shown as a little bit fierce looking usually. And so there's a verse of praise. And so this Lodra Khenchen had a dialogue with this Vajrapani, who he was in constant communication with, as Dzongkhapa was in constant communication with Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of all wisdom of all Buddhas, and Avalokiteshvara also, but especially Manjushri. And so when he would teach the Lodra Khenchen, and Lodra Khenchen would see him as one with Manjushri. And when he would receive teachings from the Lodra Khenchen in Nyingma teachings, then he would perceive the Lodra Khenchen as Vajrapani, and actually see really without difference, not just a human being there, but this kind of this angel kind of being. And this particular dialogue are answering some questions about Dzogchen, about the great completion and about advanced meditation practices, that Dzogchenpa was curious about Vajrapani's view and tantric thing. And he's giving wonderful answers. And first, before that, he makes a praise to Vajrapani, the Lord of Secrets, or the esoteric Lord. And he says, "You who are the actuality of the mind of all the Buddhas of past, present, and future, who are the great Vajradhara, Lord of Secrets," that's the sort of tantric form of Buddha, "who are blessed by Buddhas as numerous as the Ganges river sands, since your memory is like an elephant's, please teach the uttermost pinnacle of all vehicles." And that's because also in tantric scriptures, when Buddha teaches them, he is perceived by everyone who teaches as Vajradhara, who has a dark blue color and is sort of very layman, like naked, like a yogi, except for a minor like covering, and with a beautiful blue body, sometimes with a consort, sometimes without, holding Vajra and bell and so on. And he teaches the Tantra. And then if he teaches Kalachakra, he looks like Kalachakra. If he teaches Chakrasambhar, he looks like that. Vajrapani, you know, Guhya Samadhi looks like that. Then he emanates himself as Vajrapani, who in a way is same and different. They discuss it a lot in tantric texts. But then Vajrapani is the rapporteur, you know, the recorder, the one who has the perfect memory, who can remember everything that is said. And he's like a savant in that, but not an idiot savant, but a savant. Like Ananda memorizes all the sutras, and Manjushri is the one who helps organize all the Abhidharma. So Vajrapani memorizes all the tantric teachings. And so that's what he means by the pinnacle of all the vehicles. And then he has more verses of praise. And one particular thing I kind of like, he talks about many pitfalls that you can get into, that when you get into the very advanced stage, and so it's very interesting. He says, "Karma Vajra," and he asks him about what are the pitfalls of perceiving the clear light. There are many who say they perceive the clear light of the void, that's like ultimate reality is energy, you know. But there are few who cultivate illumination emptiness as communion. And of course I changed from integration, which I used to use. This is part of the second edition. Karma Vajra, there are also four points in the pitfall concerning compassion. He says, the pattern of error. This constructive thought that arises as variety, not arising as the intrinsic brilliance of clear empty awareness. No matter how it arises, it never exceeds awareness emptiness indivisible. A person who does not understand that is said to mistake awareness as emptiness, to think that only that it's just awareness is emptiness, and awareness emptiness indivisible doesn't include awareness. Awareness being not only awareness of emptiness, but awareness of relativity, of related things. So he says, a person who does not understand that is said to mistake awareness as emptiness. The sign of error, so therefore someone has a big space-like experience and they think they've reached ultimate reality and that their awareness just is the space and that any kind of differentiated experience subsequently is just some samsara and horrible nothing and is not part of reality. So they get dualistic, actually, and they then long to just disappear into this kind of nothingness. It's a very escapist and nihilistic view, mistaking awareness as emptiness. The sign of error is that he engages exclusively in the physical, verbal, and mental activities of this life, meaning that when he's in the relative world, because in fact any experience of like a blank space, even yourself as the blank space, that experience is still a relational experience. It's not the absolute. It is not. It's like, it's only like an analogy for the absolute. It seems to be what you thought the absolute must be when you were thinking emptiness was a real thing, an objective thing outside of your subjectivity. And then when you feel you sort of merge in it, your subjectivity is that emptiness. So that's mistaking awareness for emptiness, if you follow me, thinking that it is emptiness. So then just engages in them like they all don't matter. Whatever you do doesn't matter when you're in body, speech, and mind and in sort of relative reality, because you're that real reality is out there. This is all just unreal nonsense. And this can make you careless and unethical, actually. So it's a really important error. I'm so happy it's still here. The sign of error is that he engages. The fault of this error is that his attitude, that constructive thought does not arise in the truth body, causes everything that arises to be bound by the net of constructive thought. He becomes arrogant and his virtuous exertions are dissipated. So that's really interesting. So he has a theory that the Dharmakaya lacks thought, and that just unthinking being spaced out is the Dharmakaya. And therefore, when that means that he's just stuck everywhere in constructive thought. Because actually, the experience, the seeming merging one-on-one of experiencing awareness as emptiness is itself directed by constructive thought of a notion that emptiness is a vast space, as if it was itself a thing, it had its own intrinsic reality, rather than it's only the nature of the infinite interrelationality, which includes experiences of seeming being out of relationality by a relative being. That's really cool. And therefore, you end up being bound completely by constructive thought, because you even think that the place you're going to escape to is not constructive thought, but it is. And so everything is constructive thought, that means. But then you don't think that that makes any difference, that constructive thought, because you think there's a place outside of it. All constructive thoughts are empty means simply that they're there. And there's nothing absolute about any of them, including the constructive notion of emptiness as objectively being there. And being an object of awareness, even calling it non-dual, but it's still objective. It still had a boundary. There was a time before you had it. And there seems to be an aftermath when you finish meditating on it, when you fall out of it. And then it's all nothing where you are, because you're trapped and your virtuous exertions are dissipated. Since his practice emphasizes bad instincts, he achieves only the aims of this life. You just run around wanting to have fun in a negative way, not caring about the harm that you may cause in any particular version of it. Bound by the chains of dualistic suspicions and doubts, he himself binds himself. So then he thinks, well, other people, you know, they're not respecting me as the one who realized emptiness, so I'm so great, you know. The effect of this error, not knowing the pitfalls of constructive thought, meaning incorrect and inaccurate and unhelpful constructive thoughts, he becomes fixated in his instincts. He can't resist his impulses, that means. Not knowing the evils of causality, because he thinks it's all unreal, he ends his life while still on the path of vacillation. Vacillation there meaning specifically going back and forth from a state of obliteration, which he thinks is safe, absolute, ultimate Dharmakaya, and then other things which he thinks is just garbage. He's vacillating back and forth. And after death, he gets lost again in the three realms of self-centered living and suffering. Karmavajra, that's because Karmavajra means what he calls, what Vajrapani himself calls, Kenjan Lojan Namka Gyansan, who himself is a Nyingma. Adikata, because he could be both easily in those days. There are many who say they have no constructed thoughts, but there are few who understand the criterion for the liberation of whatever, the natural liberation of whatever arises. Meaning, non-duality knows emptiness as relativity. and knows that all relational things, including meditative experiences, are relative, because the being is relative. And once knows that, then all of it is the Dharmakaya. And then one knows that's what one really is, one becomes like vast, infinite, infinitely empathetic, like a Buddha, and will never be harmful to any being. How wonderful. So that's just one marvelous paragraph, which I translated and then re-edited and retranslated for this new edition. And the marvelousness comes from Vajrapani, Kenshin Lodur Gansan, and Tsongkhapa, because this is from Tsongkhapa Sumbum, even though it is a dialogue between two other people that he's a witness to. Some parts of it, they even say, may have been done when he left to go somewhere nearby. And then his disciples asked Lodur Kenshin to ask Vajrapani some further questions, sort of thing. You know, some of Tsongkhapa's disciples who had stayed. He'd been spending a few months with Lodur Kenshin. And actually, Dalai Lama's senior teacher, the wonderful Lingdur Maje, Kapje Lingthang Rinpoche, one of my root teachers and beloved person in his previous incarnation, and the new young one also, he, whenever you had mentioned Lodur Namkha Gyantsen's name, he would look like this, like remembering some being in the astral plane or something, and he would reverently bow and fold his hands in reverent prayer and gratitude, thinking that this is the one who dissuaded Tsongkhapa and his fellow disciples from leaving Tibet after Tsongkhapa's highest enlightenment and going to India on pilgrimage, since they didn't know that Nalanda and the monastery at Vajrasana, you know, Bodhgaya and Vikramashila and etc., all of them, Ratnagiri, Valabi, they were all destroyed by then, by 1400, around the year 1399, 98, 97, around that time. They'd all been wrecked, and so he got them to dissuade. This, by the way, that's the Ling Rinpoche. And this is another wisdom, wonderful publication, translation by Thupten Jinpa of biography written by His Holiness. And and Gavin Kilty, I think. Jinpa and Gavin Kilty, that's right. Jinpa and Gavin Kilty, I shouldn't say. Just Jinpa. Jinpa supervising Gavin Kilty, I think. Yes. But Jinpa introducing, that's right. But Kilty used to work for Jinpa. Here's a nice smiling picture of Ling Rinpoche. I don't know if you can see it. That he occasionally smiled. He was a great yogi of a very fierce Buddha form, Manjushri form. So he was often quite serious looking. But there he's having a nice grin. He was a wonderful guy. Really, I have marvelous stories about him, which I won't share all of them right now. But anyway, that's another great book. His Holiness's own, because you're supposed to write an autobiography of your teacher. It's like a duty, you know, of a disciple who feels truly grateful for what they learned from their teacher. Okay, so that's the thing. That's this one. That's this thing. So thank you, Life and Teaching. And this one is just to promote, to help wisdom. Although this, you know, American Institute of Buddhist Studies doesn't have a share. This is originally the production of the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, wonderful institution in Dharamsala, founded around 1970-71 in Dharamsala when I was actually there. And so I did this for them at that time. And then Mullen helped me, and Burzin was, all different translators were here. Sherpa Tuklu, Kamlan Tuklu, Alex Burzin, Jonathan Landau, and Glenn Mullen are all represented also here in this works. And I was very kid-glove in editing them. And they all remain my friends. We're all good friends. I like all of them very much. Some of them I haven't seen in way too long. But they're all great people. Okay, all the best.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. In the first half of this week's episode, Bob was sharing about the new edition of the Life and Teachings of Tsongkhapa published by Wisdom Publications. This collection of translations is a delight. I'm not usually a fan of anthologies or collections like this, but as a longtime student of Buddhism and a big fan of Bob, I found the book very, very informative. Tsongkhapa is not the easiest subject to approach if you overthink it. I was joking around with a friend of mine that Tsongkhapa is kind of like an onion, and I just didn't really understand what a great teacher and insightful master of wisdom he was until I began studying with Bob. Well, that friend, she started laughing. Turns out, Tsongkhapa's name comes from the fact that he comes from a valley known for onions. So, my subconscious must have picked that up somewhere. Either way, I hope you enjoy Bob's presentation of this book, and that you take the time to check out the edition that's now available through Amazon or directly through Wisdom Publications. Over the years, I've been deeply inspired and surprised by the things I learned from studying Tsongkhapa's teachings. And especially when my friend Bob speaks on it. Now the second half of this week's episode is a guided meditation. And this guided meditation comes from an online course that Bob does with Wisdom Publications. This ongoing online offering called Sutra and Tantra, the Profound and Miraculous, is a great online course. It's a series of lectures, recordings, and guided meditations that Professor Thurman recorded at Menla Mountain Retreat last year and is made available online. So the meditation is one of the extras that get provided to you when you sign up for this online course, but we're providing it here to you, our listeners. Stay tuned later on this week as a podcast extra. We'll be providing this meditation and one other from the Wisdom Academy online course with Robert Thurman. Special thanks to this week's co-sponsors, Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa, and Wisdom Publications. To learn more about Menla Retreat, please visit menla.us. Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special trips with Robert Thurman and geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. Trips in 2019 include Sri Lanka. Your membership and online participation help support the work of Tibet House US to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Previews from the extensive Tibet House US membership archives are available on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. Please be sure to like, subscribe, and comment on all your favorite social media platforms. Bob's on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Quora. The weekly interstitial music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is provided by Tenzing Chogyal, used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob in the second half of this week's episode.
Mindfulness. Now let's meditate together the meditation of mindfulness. After we meditate for a little while, I will give a little bit of a discussion of mindfulness, and then we'll meditate again a second time. First, sit in the proper posture for meditation. If you can, cross-legged on a comfortable cushion with your bottom a little higher than your ankles or knees, so that not much higher, like 6 inches, but like 2 or 3 inches higher if you have a second cushion to put on top of the first cushion. Cross your legs, either half lotus or full lotus if you're capable, but not if it's a strain. Sit up straight with your shoulders relaxed but down, your hands folded one on top of the other in your lap with your thumb tips lightly touching. Your chin a little bit tucked, and as if there were a little bit of a string on the very crown of your head, tippy-tip crown, pulling you upward. And your eyes half closed, and what the little bit of visual field left in the bottom part of your field of vision, limited to a spot somewhat in front of your nose. Not quite the strain of crossing your eyes, but almost close to that. That's ideal. Closing the eyes is not ideal, and wide open is not ideal. The reason for the half close is important in ancient writings, is that you create that way a very boring visual field, and you also don't go off into sleep or fantasy like when your eyes are closed. And instead you have a half visual field and a half eyelid sort of thing. So you kind of, the idea is you gradually, when you get used to doing that, you withdraw your attention from your visual field where we so often keep our attention when we're awake, and put your attention inside you. So now you begin by breathing, then you turn your attention to your breathing. And it's a little difficult when you pay attention to your breathing not to either breathe more quickly or take big deep breaths. And try not to do either of those, but breathe normally and yet observe your breath without interfering with it if possible. And then you count your breaths at the out-breath when you feel the air going out of the nostrils. You keep your lips are closed and teeth touching or close to closed, and tongue on the palate behind the upper teeth, but all in a relaxed way, not rigid or tense, and if possible, breathing evenly through the nostrils. So now you count these breaths. 1, 2, 3, 4, like that. And when your mind races off in some direction, you have an inner thought like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Am I sitting properly? What's the purpose of this? Whatever it might be, or what happened yesterday, or what I am worried about tomorrow, or what do I look forward to tomorrow. If your mind goes anywhere in the past or future, or thinking about even what you're doing now, other than just counting your breath, then notice that it has happened, and then try to withdraw from doing that. As it were, you dismount the thought train that's taking you away from just simply counting. Okay? So just do that for a couple minutes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11,
13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46,
47,
48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60.
Okay, ding, ding, ding. You can come back out. Now, you may not have kept up with me up to 60. And actually, I forgot to mention, but one way of doing it, when you reach 10, you go back to 1. And that's because, especially if you're a little bit of a beginner, maybe at 2 or 3, your mind will take you away from the count. And you'll start thinking about something. And at that point, you bring the mind back, dismounting from that distracting thought, and then start again at 1. Actually, I didn't have any distraction because I've done it enough. And even though I'm making a podcast for you, I don't think about instructions or what I'm going to do next. I manage not to do that because I often teach people this in person. And of course, when you're teaching, you always are thinking what next to say. I mean, your mind is ranging along as you go along. So I can ignore it. It doesn't take me away from what I'm doing. But if you're a beginner, I'm sure you had a lot of thoughts and questioning thoughts about why you're doing it, as well as reveries of the past and future. So let's talk a little bit about what this mindfulness is and what it's supposed to do. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, the way in which you achieve nirvana, freedom from suffering, is by recognizing that it is your true reality, actually. It isn't by doing some magical, crazy thing where you go somewhere else into some other thing. Although in a way, when you recognize that your true reality and the reality of the world is nirvana, and freedom of suffering, and that all this suffering that we undergo comes from our failure to understand the reality of our existence and the reality of the things around us that we interact with, things and persons around us that we interact with. And the minute we understand that reality, that doesn't make them all go away. But it means that we see sort of simultaneously with their reality that they do not disturb the overriding or undergirding or permeating reality of nirvana, the blowing away of suffering. But the method, and therefore the nirvana that we realize, in a way, is said to be uncreated. We don't create it, either for ourselves or for the world or anything, by achieving it or realizing it. We just ourselves come to recognize it, and in the process of recognizing it, we realize that we were always there already, but we're just distracted by our ignorance and failing to notice that it was always there. But the cause of our realization, which is a cause thing, is the Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth, which has eight components, all eight of which are necessary to realize that nirvana. And of these eight branches of this Eightfold Path, the seventh one is called mindfulness in English. In Sanskrit, it's called smriti. In Pali, it's called sati. Smriti means actually memory, to remember, remembering. So ironically, even though we call it mindfulness, and we say it's when you don't get caught up in memories, it is remembering itself. And actually what it is remembering to be present to what is happening now, rather than remembering something yesterday or the day before, or being sad or happy about something that was bad or good or whatever, which is when memory scatters us away from present awareness. And furthermore, the other way we scatter from present awareness is we anticipate the future. It's sort of like remembering to some imagination of the future. And so that also we try to diminish doing and remembering that we are in a present that is unfolding itself moment by moment. We could say remembering that we're in the present, but in a way, if you think more deeply and carefully, you can't really be in the present either, since the present is sort of like a moving instant between past and future, and you never can quite catch that instant, like a physical line in space. A line has no width, so you're never on a line, actually. A line, to be precise, a line has to be a set of coordinates, a mapping of a position or a concept of a position, but as soon as a line has any width, it's just a long rectangle. Right? So as soon as a moment has any duration, it has a beginning, middle, and end. And even the middle has a beginning, middle, and end. And it also subdivides down to split second, and then split second disappears as having any duration, just like a line disappears as having any width. So you can't actually even be in the present, but therefore you take all of your remembering and you remember what you are in process of doing and being and so on. Right? So that's the seventh branch. Now, many people might say that it is the first branch too, when you want to practice heightening your awareness. But the Buddhist tradition and the traditional teaching would not agree with that. Because we do think all the time about a lot of things. And so the first six branches involve a kind of thinking, which is good thinking as opposed to bad thinking. And the first of them, he said, the critical insight of developing what's called a realistic worldview. And a realistic worldview is a very, very important first step, involving our being critical of worldviews, you know, metaphysical theories or scientific theories that tell us things that don't really have evidence, such as that, you know, when we die, we're going to go somewhere else, thanks to God or angels or whatever, some absolutely different place. That's not true. Such as that we don't have a mind or a soul or a consciousness, really, it's just an illusion. And we're only a material configuration of brain matter and flesh and blood and so on. And the idea that our mind is actually a non-existent, a nothing, has no evidence, so that also is a dogmatic view. So a realistic worldview is only, has in a way two sides. One is that all relational things are purely causal. So it's only realistic to expect any kind of relative thing or relative experience to be caused by something and itself be the cause of something. That's the realistic worldview. Then based on that, but on that acceptance of causality, one adopts a realistic purpose of life or motivation for life. Because when you decide what is realistic, you then decide that you're embedded in causation as a relational being, and your purpose then becomes to improve the causes that produce states of being in you until finally you have no more cause of suffering and you only have causes of happiness or freedom from suffering. So those are the first two steps. Then when you have that realistic purpose or motivation, you have three ethical steps where you think in terms of being realistic about what you say, realistic speech. You think about being realistic about how you act, not only with your speech and your body, but even with your mind. You know, thinking thoughts are kind of actions. So you decide to have realistic causal or evolutionary action. And those are both connected to ethics as well as to realism. And then the third one is more socially ethical, which is realistic livelihood, meaning you don't want to have any livelihood that is unethical, that is harmful to anybody, and therefore brings harm back on yourself as its evolutionary effect. So those three follow up to five. And then you have realistic creative effort, which is sort of behind the realistic view and the purpose and the speech and the action and the livelihood, because you have to make an effort in the positive and to diminish and be critical of the negative. So realistic effort. And then finally, number seven, then you turn to, you sort of straighten yourself out with those six steps as far as being a spiritual practitioner. And then finally, in the seventh step, you use your memory to become present of what you are doing now, taking all of those things into consideration. Am I being realistic in my worldview, in my motivation, in my speech, in my action, in my livelihood, and in my creativity? Or am I being unrealistic? And that's sort of, you begin to mobilize the mind to examine and to deepen and to also look deeper into how your mind is working to find more vestiges of unrealistic attitudes and actions and behaviors and laziness, which is unrealistic, or lack of effort. Mindfulness does that. And then this eighth step that mindfulness then leads to is where you come to see the deeper, through mindfulness, you range into the deeper levels of your mind. And then the last step is samadhi, which means concentration in one point. And that's where you sort of drill down deeper into your own reality and you discover your real nature. And ultimately that real nature is freedom from suffering, It's the bliss of emptiness, the clear light of emptiness. And when you find that, then you feel bliss everywhere, because you realize it is everywhere. But that's jumping a little bit ahead to some of the other podcasts and teachings. So now, so that's sort of how mindfulness is located. And the beginning place that we do when we start mindfulness, which is not the whole of it, but is the good starting point, is where you count your breath and focus on it. Or you could actually think of a mantra, you know, just repeat a word internally with, or murmur it even with your softly with your voice. So you don't have to only count your breath, but that's considered to be very easy and very important. And in a way, we're normally unconscious of our breath. We breathe without paying attention to it. And so it's sort of a bit of realism to observe that we breathe. So it's a good place to start. But the main point of that one is to then notice how your mind is filled with jumbles of distracting thoughts that go run here and there, memories, anticipations, you know, criticisms, expressions of dissatisfaction, or expressions of glee and joy, but all kinds of commentaries, let's say, on what we're actually is happening and where we actually are. And so we're looking at those and learning to dismount from them by disidentifying from being automatically pushed by this or that thought, like, I must do this, I must do that, I must feel this way, I must feel that way. You begin to gain a little freedom and begin to observe the reactive and active and proactive mechanisms in your mind where your mental energy normally gets scattered. And then by learning to dismount from that scattering, you gain a better control over the way your mind works. And then you come to the deeper levels of mindfulness where you can kind of edit so as to weaken negative habitual thoughts and reinforce and strengthen positive thoughts, you know, and make them, which are maybe not so habitual, but you want to make them habitual. So mindfulness goes deeper like that before you shift from it into the deeper samadhi, which is, it's a Sanskrit word, but it's so well known in English now, it's almost gotten into the English dictionary, meaning drilling down very, very stable concentration. Okay, now let's go back and let's meditate again within this context. Okay? Don't even worry about or think about what I just said. Hopefully you can replay the podcast. But forget about it for a moment. Notice that you're breathing. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Ding.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Bob Thurman Podcast. I'm deeply grateful for all the shares, likes, comments, and subscriptions we get. And if you'd like to reach me personally, I can be found on most social media platforms as Justin Stone. If you have specific suggestions, comments, or just want to share an idea with me, please email me directly via my personal email, which is justin@menla.org. I look forward to hearing from you. Tashi Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.